Cities and states are acting. Businesses are acting. I'm acting. We need Congress to act as well. We talk about, you know, a couple, there's only two senators occasionally don't vote with me. That's right, right? Literally, 48, they talk about the split in the Democratic Party. There's virtually no split in the Democratic Party. We just happen to have 50 presidents. You know, you have 50 senators and 50 Democrats, 50 Republicans. I mean, anyone can change the dynamic, right?
President Biden speaking on Earth Day last week, throwing in a not-so-subtle dig at the two Democratic senators blocking his legislation on climate, West Virginia's Joe Manchin and Arizona's Kyrsten Sinema. Manchin, whose family owns a coal company, has been a big roadblock to getting climate legislation passed. And with Republicans likely to win back the House in the November midterms, climate activists and Democrats worry the next few months will be the last chance the country has to avoid catastrophic global warming. So environmental groups are putting the hard press on congressional Democrats this week to get something, anything passed. Josh Siegel is an energy and climate reporter covering Congress for Politico. Hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Great. Great, thanks. Great to have you. All right, so initially, the president's climate agenda was part of this big Build Back Better legislation, which pretty much died in the Senate. So now what is the thinking when it comes to climate? Will there be a standalone bill?
So it wouldn't exactly be a standalone bill, but the way that proponents are thinking about it and climate activists that you mentioned are conceiving it would be that there would be a smaller package that would get rid of some of the social policies that just don't have the support of which might be appropriate, but Senator Joe Manchin, who is the key vote here. And he, has expressed, somewhat optimism about doing something on clean energy and climate, along with drug pricing and Affordable Health Care Act subsidies, but he hasn't expressed support for things like the child tax credit, free community college, other kind of social policies that were originally in this Build Back Better. So the thinking is, can they do something just, with fewer things in it? And, at first it was interesting that a lot of the climate environmental groups actually were very reluctant to make these decisions on prioritization as far as the broader social agenda, because they increasingly saw these issues as somewhat connected and also motivators for voters. And they felt like climate voters, really supported the whole package of things. But, in my reporting over the last couple of weeks, I've picked up on that the climate activists, environmental groups are very much saying, okay, we have a limited window here before midterm election season really gets going. We need to simplify this. We need to do what Manchin is saying that he might be willing to do, and just kind of cut things that he's not willing to do. So that's where we're at.
Yeah. Okay. So what does that look like? What would a bill look like that Manchin would support, and would it be effective enough to combat climate change?
Yeah. So from a climate perspective, again, broadly, Senator Manchin has said that he's supportive of providing, tax credits is essentially the main vehicle here. So, for at least a decade, we've had tax credits supporting wind and solar that has really helped those two zero carbon renewable resources, grow on our electric grid. And the idea now would be to do these credits, extend those wind and solar, and then also apply subsidies to other technologies that are clean, that are maybe more nascent and that potentially need government support, carbon capture that can be applied to, fossil fuel plants as well as industrial manufacturing facilities. You have transmission lines that essentially bring wind and solar from rural areas where they're produced to consuming areas like New York City or, big population centers. And then hydrogen is another, clean resource that's supported here. So basically supercharging these tax credits in the way that we've thought about them in recent years and really making them more significant. And, a lot of climate activists say this would make a huge difference as far as our emissions. So, the president has said he wants to have an entirely carbon-free grid, power grid by 2035. And they're saying that is totally unfeasible unless these tax credits are there. Now, to be clear, we don't really know exactly, there's very few specifics out there as far as what Manchin within those credits, is willing to do. And he's said a few things on things he wants to see. He's supportive of the carbon capture piece I mentioned, because his state, West Virginia, is very big on fossil fuels, right? So he wants to see support for that. Nuclear energy, there would be tax credits for nuclear energy. That's another area he's very interested in, hydrogen as well. So he's kind of, you know, said here individual pieces that I like, but he hasn't, you know, full-fledged said, oh, I like the entirety of it. But most people think he, you know, he could be able to deal there, but we just haven't seen specific evidence yet.
But isn't the main problem that he is so pro-coal in his state? And, well, personally, he makes a lot of money from coal, but he hasn't been willing to get, for instance, big power generators, the utilities, to transition off coal, off fossil fuels, onto clean energy, because it would really hurt his state.
Yeah.
And he's pretty popular in his state. I think he was just voted the most popular amongst the most popular Democratic senators in the country. So why would he do anything to give that up?
Well, I mean, I obviously can't speculate on his motives. There's been plenty of reporting on his personal, you know, finances and his ties to fossil fuels. Interestingly, West Virginia there is a transition happening off coal. I mean, it is slow, and it's also natural gas. I mean, it's a huge natural gas producing state. So I think, if anything, that might explain his reluctance more so than coal, mm-hmm. because, you know, he's been, I mean, the writing's on the wall with coal. Natural gas is, you know, of course, has been seen as cleaner than coal, but still is, you know, has concerns around methane and just the timelines we're dealing with climate, like, you know, we're not sure how long we could have natural gas stick around. So yes, he's been very reluctant to do anything that would threaten that. You know, there was specific measure that was in the original version of Build Back Better that would have actually directly penalized utilities that didn't make the transition fast enough to cleaner sources. And he was totally not into that, because yes, I mean, that would have really threatened natural gas, coal, definitely natural gas as well. So, you know, when what's out there, you know, the tax credits, I think would have a big impact as far as making a transition, but they're less directly. I mean, you know, they're not penalizing coal and gas directly. It's just kind of helping out those competitors. Yeah.
And Josh, you know, time is of the essence. What is the deadline for getting anything passed?
Yeah, so increasingly members I'm talking with, Democrats, really see this current work period that they're in. So it's about 6 weeks here that they're in session. So by Memorial Day, they would say, we need a framework. We need like an agreement, you know, not necessarily legislative text and a vote, but we need an agreement with Manchin. And others, you know, Kristen Sinema of Arizona is a senator who's also, you know, somewhat, you know, we're not sure if she'll support a final package. So that's when they are hoping to have an agreement. And then July 4th is kind of what they're eyeing to actually, you know, really pass something. And the reasoning, of course, is, as I mentioned earlier, we're in a midterm election year, and the summer is usually not productive for policy. It's usually full campaign mode. And if there's nothing done in that time, you know, the Democrats are very upfront and saying we're going to have to fold and kind of campaign on some of the other, you know, smaller policies, legislation that they have passed. Yeah.
All right. Josh, thanks so much for the update.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Josh Siegel is an energy and climate reporter. He covers Congress for Politico. Democrats in Washington pushed to pass some kind of climate legislation. Southern California officials are ordering new water restrictions here because of the drought. Starting in June, around 6 million people in parts of LA, Ventura, and San Bernardino counties will be restricted to outdoor watering just once a week. That order from the Metropolitan Water District is unprecedented, and it illustrates the trickle-down effects of climate change. So what would the next mayor of Los Angeles do to address this problem? Sammy Roth, who covers energy and the environment for the LA Times, put that question to the candidates, and he's here now. Hi.
Hey.
All right. So I don't know how much you can answer questions about this latest order, but just looking at the map, it says 6 million people here in Southern California are affected by these new restrictions. Who is not affected?
Gosh, that's a good question. I mean, the 6 million who are affected are across Los Angeles, Ventura, and San Bernardino counties, or at least parts of those counties. So about half is the city of Los Angeles. Then you've got some folks in, you know, in the Inland Empire and in Burbank and in San Fernando. I mean, pretty much everyone else not affected.
Right. Okay. And this goes into effect in June. And it'll be enforced by local officials?
Yes, it'll be up to folks like LADWP to enforce it.
Okay, great. All right, let's talk about the answers that you got to some of these questions that you posed to some of the mayoral candidates. You spoke with Congresswoman Karen Bass, City Councilman Joe Buscaino, Kevin DeLeon, also City Councilman, and City Attorney Mike Feuer. And I guess Rick Caruso sent in a statement about his climate plans. What do they agree on?
So of the four candidates I talked to, there was a pretty good amount of agreement. They all support the goal that's been set by Mayor Garcetti to get 100% of Los Angeles's electricity from clean sources by 2035. They're all on board as well with ways to source more of the city's water supply locally. So Garcetti wants to get 70% of the city's water locally by 2035. And all the candidates I spoke with supported that. In fact, Mike Feuer, the city attorney, even said he wanted to do one better and do 75%.
Is that even possible, given how little it rains here and what a deep drought we are in?
I think it's possible. It doesn't mean it'll be easy. It'll require all sorts of investment and changes in the way we do things with our infrastructure. But I do think it's possible.
What about desalination?
Joe Buscaino from the city council said that he'd be interested in exploring that. There is a desalination plant that's proposed in Huntington Beach right now, which would be the first, you know, big new desalination plant in California in a while. And that wouldn't serve Los Angeles, but it is something that's being talked about here in Southern California.
Okay, so that's water. What about the air? Los Angeles is one of the dirtiest cities, if not the dirtiest city in the nation when it comes to our air. What would the candidates do to clean that up?
Yeah, so again, sort of some general agreement here that there's a need to, one, help people in Los Angeles spend more time not driving around in their cars. There was a lot of discussion about how to make public transit, you know, safer and more comfortable for people. Kevin DeLeon, for instance, said he wanted free transit for people under the age of 25. Karen Bass talked about trying to help people work from home more, sort of take advantage of the Zoom boom, maybe stagger in-person schedules for office workers. And lots of discussion about the ports as well. The ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach are an enormous source of air pollution. Buscaino talked about wanting to invest in natural gas equipment down there, which is cleaner than diesel, but not as clean as all electric. General agreement across the board, need to get people out of cars and make transit cleaner.
How much power does the Los Angeles mayor have over the ports and the air pollution generated there?
The mayor of LA appoints at least some of the members to the board of commissioners of the Port of Los Angeles. I can't remember offhand if it's all the members, but at least some of them. The mayor of LA also appoints members to the Air Quality Management District of Southern California, which regulates air quality at the port and elsewhere. Not to mention the board of DWP. So, the mayor does have, you know, a pretty strong hand in some of this, but it depends a lot on how much political capital they really want to put into this. I mean, one comment that Mike Feuer, the city attorney, made to me was that, he thinks there has just not been a recent history of the mayor really being assertive in sort of reshaping the urban infrastructure of Los Angeles to clean up the air. He said he would focus on that.
Well, does that mean creating more bike lanes, more car-free areas?
It probably does. I mean, we actually, the LA Times co-sponsored a poll a couple of weeks ago where we asked registered voters in Los Angeles, how they would feel about some of those ideas. And there was pretty strong support. There was 83% support for adding more rail lines, 60% support for converting more traffic lanes to bus only. People say they want these sorts of things, and it's, you know, I think largely a question of whether whoever becomes the next mayor of Los Angeles is really willing to push for it.
But then there's the reality when it comes to commuting or driving anywhere or getting anywhere in Los Angeles. It's easier for most people to hop in a car than to get on public transportation. And then people who are in their cars really hate the fact that there's all this construction going on, building the subways and public transportation, because, and even taking away lanes for bikes, because it means a more frustrating commute for people in their cars. So it's a tough reality. It's a conundrum.
It is. I mean, Los Angeles was built by and for cars in a lot of ways. We are a freeway and car centric city. And, you know, you're right. Even though people say, you know, when they answer a poll question that they support these things and the mayoral candidates say they want to do it, I mean, this is, you know, this has been the thing in a while for Los Angeles. City council members have a lot of power to block projects in their districts. And so when they're hearing from homeowners, you know, no, I don't want this transit stop, or I don't want this protected, you know, bike lane through this business corridor, they have the power to squash that stuff. So, you know, the mayor has some ability to push back and to sort of use the bully pulpit, but the politics are difficult for sure.
So who out of the candidates you interviewed, who has the most detailed, comprehensive, and serious plan to attack climate change in Los Angeles?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I'd start by saying Mike Feuer was out with a climate plan before any of the rest of the candidates. He's had details on his website for months on how he would go about some of this stuff. I should say that Bass was endorsed by the Sierra Club locally, which is one of the most influential, politically active environmental groups. They appreciate that she supported the Green New Deal early on, and they threw their endorsement to her. She's one of the leading two candidates right now in the polls, along with Rick Caruso. I should say about Caruso, by the way, they sent me a written statement at the very last minute, but you know, all of these other candidates agreed to get on the phone and talk about climate in detail. The Caruso campaign told me for a period of 2 weeks that he was going to do that. He was going to talk to me. It never happened. They say he's going to release a climate plan soon. Haven't seen it yet. I think it's a really big question mark where he stands on some of these issues and how much attention and priority he would give to climate.
Sammy Roth, he covers energy for the Los Angeles Times. Sammy, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the electrical vehicle bonanza, even Corvette is getting in on it. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Corvette's vroom vroom is going to be more of a whoosh whoosh. GM announced this week it'll build an electric Corvette. The Corvette is one of many sports cars getting such a makeover. Ferrari also plans to release an EV in a few years, which is pretty smart when you consider Californians are among the top buyers of that brand in the country. And California wants all new car sales to be electric by 2035. Joining us to talk about this rush to go electric is Aaron Robinson. He is editor-at-large for Hagerty. Welcome back, Aaron.
Happy to be with you, Madeline.
All right. So by 2035, all new cars sold in California should be electric. That's what California wants. So do these luxury car makers have any choice, really?
They don't have a choice, but they are more optimistic that people will actually buy these cars than they were maybe even a year ago, as recently as a year ago. Before, there was the sense of the government's making us do this. I guess we have to, produce some electric vehicles. Now there's a much greater optimism about whether the buyers are actually going to buy them. There's waiting lists for a lot of electric vehicles. They're selling in much bigger numbers than the industry had predicted. Everybody's busy rewriting their electrification plans. Wall Street is rewarding companies that are very proactive about electrification. So there's been a big snowball just within the last year, 8-10 months.
And why is that? Is that partially due to high gas prices?
Well, it is, but it's also because nobody really knew what the consumer was going to do, because you couldn't really base your predictions on what had already happened, because the electric vehicles that have been available to us have been kind of these small little hatchback city cars, which most people don't want. Most people want crossovers or bigger vehicles, pickup trucks, and there just hasn't been any choices for those until very recently. And so nobody knew whether anybody was going to buy them. Well, it turns out people want them. They're standing in line for them. The F-150 Lightning, the pickup truck, has a huge line for it. So it turns out that there is a market for these.
Well, so who is the market? Because these are more expensive than traditional cars, right? When you look at the Ford F-150, the electric version is more expensive, right?
It's more expensive, but if you look at what pickup trucks are selling for anyway, I mean, if you walk into a Ford dealership with an F-150, I mean, if you're going to get out for less than $50,000 or $60,000, you're doing pretty well. And so electric vehicles put in that context aren't that crazy expensive. And there are a lot of people willing to consider an alternate powertrain. I mean, you know, a guy goes by his new Lamborghini and he's sitting in a stoplight and, you know, he gets his doors blown off by a guy in a Model 3 and he goes, a Tesla Model 3, and he goes, you know, maybe there's something to this. I mean, there is now a sense that electrification is the future. It's an advanced technology. People who have electric cars are telling all their friends, this thing's great. It's quiet. I charge it at home. I haven't been to a gas station in 2 years. I never run out of, you know, the range because I just don't drive it that far. And, you know, I mean, a lot of people who have these cars now are, you know, telling their neighbors and friends, hey, this thing's great. They just love it. And so the word's getting out.
And do we have Tesla to thank for all that or blame?
I think, well, definitely. I mean, I think Elon Musk has written his name into history for a lot of reasons, but also for really expanding people's notion of what an electric vehicle is. Because, of course, before that, we had these compliance cars, these little hatchbacks that didn't seem very sexy. And Elon Musk made the electric vehicle sexy and paved the way for all of the rest of the industry to now come out with much broader product lines, which are going to draw a much broader audience. So much more diverse types of people are going to be buying electric vehicles simply because there's much more diverse types of vehicles that are going to be electrified.
What about the charging part of it? Because, yeah, sure, people can charge at home, but once they take a road trip, where do they charge these things if it's not a Tesla?
Well, it remains an issue to a certain extent, especially for people who live communally and, you know, in apartment buildings, that sort of thing. Charging infrastructure is not there to support a complete switch from internal combustion engine to electric and have everybody be able to recharge conveniently. However, most people who have electric cars and charge at home will tell you that they rarely use a public charger simply because they just manage their life, you know, in a way that if they know they're going a long distance one day, they'll make sure the car is fully charged the night before, or whatever it is. I mean, they'd much rather charge it at home than at a public charger. And so it's an open question about how big an issue public charging is for most of the nation. And let's remember, most of the nation is suburban. I mean, we live in the suburbs. It's not true in Europe, it's not true in Asia, but it's definitely true of the United States. And so many more people who have cars and certainly the means to buy new cars and electric Corvettes have, you know, the capability of charging at home. So it's not clear how big of an impediment, although there is a sense that Tesla has a huge advantage having built a charging infrastructure ahead of everybody else.
And you can't use the Tesla charging stations for other cars, right?
Not presently, no. Although I think there was talk about having, they use a different plug, although there's talk about having an adapter. But the industry is moving towards an 800 volt standard. So all the vehicles will be 800 volts. Some are 400, there's a few that are 800. So the industry is kind of converging on a common voltage standard, which will make universal charging and quick charging much more accessible. And you're going to see these things pop up in Walmart parking lots. The Aldi supermarket near me in Torrance has a line of these chargers, and they will be everywhere pretty soon.
What about the vroom vroom I mentioned? Is that gone now forever?
Well, I don't think it's gone forever. There'll always be people interested in internal combustion, the same way people buy these really expensive ornate watches that do all kinds of things, but, you know, break often and you have to send them to the factory to be serviced. You know, there's still always be an interest in it, but it's going to get a lot more difficult to buy gasoline as commonly as we do today. And if you look at sports car buyers, like Corvette buyers, sports car buyers are interested in technology. They're interested in a lot of things, but first and foremost, they're interested in going fast. And right now, the state of the art in fast is electric. And so that is never going to change. People are going to want to go fast. And so it almost doesn't matter what makes them go fast, as long as they go fast. And sports car buyers are really quite willing to accept new technology. They accepted the pervasiveness of automatic transmissions in sports cars a long time ago. They accepted electronic stability controls. They're going to like the fact that electric cars have their weight well low in the car, so that it's a low center of gravity, which makes the cars handle better. So there's no question in my mind that they'll accept an electric Corvette, no doubt.
Okay. All right. Aaron Robinson, editor-at-large for Hagerty. Thank you, Aaron.
As always.
Coming up, elite colleges and universities had record numbers of applicants this year, partly because they didn't have to submit SAT or ACT test scores.
Kids who may not have applied to very high-end schools because their board scores weren't, you know, in the top 5 or 10%, figured they had a puncher's chance this year because they didn't have to take them or submit them.
That's next on Press Play.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Branwell. College-bound seniors have until Sunday, May 1st, to commit to their schools for next year. And it's been a rough process for many of them. It was a record year for applications for many elite colleges and universities, meaning it was also a record year for rejection letters. And here to tell us why is Doug Belkin. He covers higher education for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, why was it a record year for rejection letters and for applications?
You know, it was kind of a scramble this year. A lot of different forces were in play. Probably the most significant was the most schools around the country now have gone test optional or gotten rid of the SATs and the ACT altogether. So kids who may not have applied to very high-end schools because their board scores weren't, you know, in the top 5 or 10%, figured they had a puncher's chance this year because they didn't have to take them or submit them. So I think a lot of kids just applied hoping that their grades alone would carry them through. Some of the kids who had deferred last year because of COVID, they didn't want to take classes online, took up some of the seats for this year. You know, they were already accepted, so they took up seats coming in. The international students came back this year. So a lot of forces were increasing the number of applications that the schools received.
And so how did that play out when they came to choosing who would be the incoming freshman class? Did they change the way that they looked at their candidates?
Yeah, they did, because they didn't have one significant data point to measure the students against, right? The SAT and the ACT provided, what purported to be a benchmarked examination that you could objectively compare students to. And that's been the source of a lot of contention around the country, and schools have decided that it just isn't working. So with that gone, they've placed more emphasis on grades, GPA, extracurricular activities, the rigor of the curriculum that you took. They're also looking to build diverse classes. So I think the buckets that you fall into in terms of your demography were also weighted heavily this year.
And so some kids who would have been shoo-ins in previous years were finding themselves scrambling. And you profiled one girl named Caitlin Younger in Texas, and she had everything going for her. She applied to Stanford, Harvard, Yale, Brown, Cornell, Penn, Berkeley, etc., and was rejected from all of them. Tell us about her.
Yeah, interesting kid, really brilliant young woman. She started studying algebra in third grade and had taken a dozen advanced placement classes over the course of her high school career and gotten fives and fours on all her exams and scored, you know, in the top 1% on the SAT and had a super high GPA. But she came from the admissions folks call them buckets. She was a white woman from a public high school in Texas who wanted to study business. And so each of those characteristics placed her in a really large bucket. She was competing with a lot of kids because the schools generally try to take a certain amount of kids from each of these buckets so that they have a diverse class. And that's all of those things made her very difficult for her to get in because each of those buckets is large and competitive. So she just got shut out.
But she wasn't wealthy, right? And she didn't have, she wasn't like a legacy or a donor family or anything like that. And so you would think that in terms of demographics, economically, she looked good, at least.
No. If you have a lot of money so that you're connected, that you can make a donation, that the schools think you might be able to make a donation down the line, then that can be a positive advantage for you. If you're poor, that can help in the sense that the schools want to have a social economic diversity. If you're in the middle class, there's a lot of middle class kids who are applying. So it doesn't give you an advantage one way or the other. You're competing with the largest pool of kids. So it doesn't really work for you.
So what happened when she was rejected from all of these schools? What did she do?
I think she cried and she was sad. Yeah. Like about 10 million other kids this year, you know, who got rejected from high end schools. She ended up getting waitlisted at Rice, which is a great school, but she won't go there. She didn't even put herself onto the waitlist because she didn't think she could afford it. She was accepted to the University of Texas at Austin, which is a terrific school, but she did not get accepted to the business program, and she's focused on business, so she did not go there. Instead, she accepted admission to Arizona State University to their business program, and she got a pretty good scholarship there, so she'll be heading there in the fall.
And how does she feel about that?
I think she's excited to sort of put this chapter behind her. She worked very hard and was disappointed, deeply disappointed, that she didn't get into any of these other elite schools. But she'll graduate without any debt, and that's a big deal. And her parents are emphasizing that they think that graduate school is even more important. So she sort of has her eyes in the future as well.
So all of this competition for these elite colleges, what does that mean for colleges like ASU or others further downstream? Are they also getting a lot of applicants?
There's a real bifurcation happening, and it's been going on for a long time. Colleges and universities around the country are essentially overbuilt right now for the number of high school graduates coming out of them. And so in the Northeast and in the Midwest in particular, where the demography is upside down and fewer kids are graduating high school, especially the private schools and the regional publics are scrambling to fill their classes. But the elite schools and the flagship schools tend to be oversubscribed. So there's sort of a flight to quality that's been happening for a number of years, and students are pushing to get into these schools. But a lot of the schools that are, sort of second or third tier schoolers are scrambling and closing or merging or on the cusp of either.
Although you can get a top flight education at these schools, right? It's just they don't have the reputation, deservedly or not.
You can get a great education almost anywhere. It's just a question of, from the perspective of a 17-year-old, a lot of times they're thinking, well, if I'm going to pay all of this money, if my parents are going to put out all of this money, if I'm going to go into this kind of debt, I want a brand name on my diploma. And so they're scrambling for those. There's just a lot of risk involved in heading to college right now.
So what does this all mean as you're looking forward into the future of higher ed? Do you think that it will in general be saner for kids with lower prices and they'll be able to afford better education, or what's going to happen?
I think the big picture, the four-year degree as the end-all be-all is eroding a little bit. There's more pathways now into the labor market than there was even a decade ago. You know, you can get a credential from Google. You can get a credential from Microsoft. There are more apprenticeships now that the federal government is sponsoring. So there are different pathways to get into the labor market. The schools themselves are beginning to focus more on helping kids get jobs afterwards, so that they're a little bit more aligned with the labor market as well. The very high-end schools that she was trying to get into will continue to be very difficult to get into. These are now international brands. They're elite brands, and the demand for them is not going to decline anytime soon. The third-tier schools will probably, some of them are probably going to close or merge.
Hmm. And how many of these elite brand name schools are there?
It depends how you mark them. You know, people usually talk about the top 50 schools in the country, the top 100 schools of the country. There's somewhere around a 2,000 four-year schools. So it's just that top 5% or so.
The top 5% and thousands upon thousands of applicants.
I think Harvard had 60-something thousand for, 2,200 spots.
That's crazy. How does an admissions officer choose from 60,000 kids?
You know, it's a conundrum for them, because just thinking about how do you get through that many applicants, you hire a lot of people, and then you spend very little time on each application, and you weed out as many as you can as quickly as you can, so you can get to a smaller pool and then spend more time figuring it out. So we had a story a few years ago that looked at the average amount of time that an admissions committee spent on an application. It was less than 8 minutes. So you spend, 4 years working hard toward developing an application, and you spend hours and hours writing your essay and studying for your SATs, and then it's really looked at very quickly.
Wow. Well, Doug, thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Doug Belkin, higher education reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Coming up, how to use the wok. A new cookbook is dedicated to it. We'll talk with the author, Kenji Lopez Alt, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Cookbook author Kenji Lopez Alt has built a career out of teaching people the science behind better home cooking. His first book, The Food Lab, was basically an encyclopedia of kitchen hacks and techniques with detailed instructions on how to, say, perfectly sear a steak or cook a professional omelet. And I'm not exaggerating when I call it an encyclopedia. The book was nearly 1,000 pages and weighed more than 6 pounds. Well, Lopez Alt is back with a new, slightly less heavy cookbook. This time, it's all centered around cooking with one pan, the wok. And while the wok is most commonly associated with Chinese cuisine, Lopez Alt says it can be used to cook all kinds of dishes. And Kenji Lopez Alt joins me now. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I am well, thank you. So when did you get the religion with the wok? When did the wok first come into your life and you realized, this is it for me? I only need this one pan.
Well, I wouldn't say I only need this one pan, but it is definitely the pan that I pick most often out of everything that I have in my kitchen. I grew up in a Japanese-American household, and my mom cooked a bunch of dishes in the wok, although it wasn't the only pan she used. I got my wok basically right around the time I started cooking, which was in college. I got my wok for, I think, like $30 at a Target in Somerville. And I literally just cooked in it yesterday. So it's been the pan that, throughout my entire adult life, from the time I was in college till while I was living single and with roommates, having dinner parties, when I was living with my wife, and now, feeding my whole family with it. It's the one pan that has spent the most time on my stovetop. It's virtually always on my stovetop, either that or sort of hanging up right next to it, and I use it multiple times a week. It's extremely versatile, so, you can do everything from making stock in it to obviously stir frying. It's the best tool for deep frying. It's the best tool for steaming. You can smoke in it. There's a whole slew of things you can do in a wok. But moreover, it's also just an extremely practical tool for all kinds of cooking. So particularly for sort of weeknight cooking, whether you're having friends over or you're cooking for your family and you only have like half an hour. It's like I sound like an infomercial talking about this. It is really true. Yeah. And it's funny because the infomercial, there's an infomercial from the 80s. That I grew up watching called The Great Wok of China, selling woks. And it really is like the first time I really started paying attention to woks, and everything they said in it was true.
Right. So I always associated a wok with stir fry, and that's pretty much it. Like, I didn't consider other kinds of cooking in it, like cooking an omelet or, I don't know, cooking pasta or whatever it is that is usually done in other pans. But you say you can cook all of these other non-Chinese dishes in the wok?
Yeah. I mean, you know, most of the book focuses on East Asian techniques. So a lot of it is Chinese. A lot of it is sort of Chinese-American dishes that, you know, I was familiar with growing up. There's a bunch of sort of Japanese stuff in there, as well as other sort of Southeast Asian recipes. But yeah, certainly you're by no means, you know, relegated to doing that. You know, so one example that I frequently bring up when people ask, like, you know, what is something that I would do in a Western pan that is actually better in a wok is deep frying. So a lot of people are afraid of deep frying. And I think a lot of that comes down to the difficulties of using something like a Dutch oven or a stock pot and the mess that it can make when you add food to it. It can bubble over. People are afraid of setting fires. And a wok, you know, because of its flared shape, it has these wide sides that come out really wide. And so when you put food in it to deep fry, you know, first of all, any sort of oil that splatters, it gets caught on the sides of the wok instead of going over and onto your stovetop. So there's less cleanup. And then you can also sort of get a, you know, metal spider or a strainer and maneuver stuff in there more easily, which is also, I think, what makes it easier to do things like poaching or simmering. So even things like pasta, you know, like they work really well in a wok because it's very easy to get like a spider or a strainer under there to move things around. Poaching eggs is really easy in a wok. Just as an example.
Are all woks created equal, or are there really, do you have to get one made of a certain material and a certain shape? There are the round bottom ones and the flat bottom ones.
Right. Well, so it depends what cooking equipment you have. For the vast majority of people cooking in the West, I would recommend a flat bottom wok because our stovetops are designed to hold flat bottom pans. So, you know, you can get special adapters like a wok ring that'll hold a round bottom wok, but it doesn't really effectively work as well as just getting a flat bottom wok that's going to sit flat in your stovetop and is going to be stable for you. So definitely I would recommend getting a flat bottom wok. I recommend about 14 inches for the average home cook. You know, you can get away with a little bit smaller, 12 inches, if you don't generally cook for more than three people or so. But generally I'd say 14 inches is what you want. As far as material goes, you know, there's a wide range of materials. If you already have a wok, that's say like a nonstick wok, you know, the vast majority of the recipes that I do in my book, you're going to be able to make to some degree. But if you really want the best results and the most versatility, I recommend carbon steel. It imparts flavor to your food that you don't get out of nonstick, that you don't get out of stainless steel. It's virtually indestructible. You know, like I said, I've had mine for over 20 years, and I know people who've had woks for much, carbon steel woks for much longer than that. It develops a nonstick coating with use. Just naturally through use, it'll turn nonstick. Yeah, if you're buying a new wok, I would recommend 14 inch, about a millimeter to 2 millimeter thick. So it's 14 to 16 gauge carbon steel flat bottom wok, which you can find. I mean, virtually any shop that carries woks will have something like that.
Okay, let's talk about how we cook in it, because we cook in it differently than we would in a Western style pan. First of all, it has to be really hot, right?
Well, for a lot of dishes, yes. Not for every dish. You know, I think there's this sort of misconception that people have, that, you know, I had a long time as well growing up, that you need like a, you know, 150,000 BTU per hour restaurant style burner to cook properly in a wok. And I see this come up a lot, that people online especially will say, oh, you know, like, you can't really do wok cooking without a restaurant style burner. You need this high heat output. But, you know, the truth is that there are, you know, literally hundreds of millions of people who cook in a wok every day who don't all have restaurant style burners
right.
in their home kitchens, right? It's almost like asking someone in the West, like, you know, it's like when we go to a steakhouse with a really hot broiler, you know, you go there, that's a restaurant style dish, and you don't expect your home cooked steak to taste like the one that you get at the fancy steakhouse. So it's just sort of a matter of resetting your expectations a little bit about the types of dishes that you can cook. You know, that said, there are sort of techniques that you can use and some things, some sort of hacks, as you would call them, that I put in the book for how you can achieve those flavors at home, no matter what kind of range you have. But yeah, the idea that you need really, really high heat to cook in a wok all the time is sort of a myth that I try in the book to set people's expectations a little bit differently.
But what is the idea behind having it really hot, or just having it hot for this, for stir fry in general?
Right. In a wok, the reason you want really high heat is much more about evaporating moisture very rapidly. And that's where the tossing action of stir frying also comes in. So all of that, you know, the preheating the wok to very high heat, having this kind of column of hot air that rises up behind the wok as you toss it, and moving the food through the air to sort of really get convection going and encourage surface moisture evaporation as fast as possible. Because what you're trying to do in the wok is cook the food rapidly, and you know, moisture takes a lot of energy to evaporate, and what can happen is if your wok isn't hot enough, or if you aren't tossing continuously as you cook with it, or at least relatively frequently as you cook with it, moisture ends up kind of collecting on the bottom of the pan. So instead of steaming off and flying up into the air, it'll end up sort of collecting on the bottom of the wok, and you end up stewing things instead of really stir-frying things. So that's why you typically want really high heat, is that you want everything to stay kind of dry and the flavors to stay concentrated and for things to cook rapidly and develop more flavor.
Can you talk about the toss? Because I'm a little intimidated by the idea that when you're stir-frying, you're not just stirring. You actually have to do that chef toss thing. And it seems so intimidating, and that I feel like I'll get all my food all over the counter and the burner and ruin dinner.
Yeah, well, it's called stir fry, but really it should be called toss fry, because tossing is really the essential action there, getting the food up into the air so that moisture can evaporate and the food can cook rapidly and evenly. So, you know, that is one of those things where you kind of just have to practice it, you know, and in the book, you know, that I have some photo guides to how you're supposed to be tossing. Essentially, it's kind of like you're tilting the wok forward and pushing it forward and then rapidly jerking it backwards so that the food kind of cascades over itself. And I would recommend starting with simpler recipes. So something like a mapo tofu or Thai pork with basil that are relatively forgiving dishes. So even if you don't perfectly toss them, they're still going to come out great because they're kind of these moister dishes that don't rely so much on the perfect evaporation. Whereas something like beef chow fun, that's probably the most difficult recipe in the book, and well known to be a difficult recipe for chefs. You know, it's in the same way that a French chef might measure the skill of a cook by how well they make a perfect omelet. You know, a Cantonese chef would measure how good a cook is by watching them make beef chow fun, because there's a lot going on in there. The noodles tend to be rather delicate, and they also tend to be sticky, and so you have to be tossing them properly without breaking them, and you have to add the soy sauce at the right way so that it doesn't turn soupy and it kind of sears. So it involves a bunch of techniques that you kind of have to build up to. The good news is that even if you don't do it perfectly, it's still going to be perfectly edible and it'll still be delicious. But sort of that gap between good and perfect is a really difficult one to achieve. I don't want to sugarcoat it. There are some recipes in the book that you are going to just have to practice that motion with.
But why is that key? Why is the tossing so important?
Well, so it goes back to the idea that you want to be tossing it so that your food is rising up through this column of air and is getting as much sort of convection as possible. You know, in the same way that if you put your hands under a blow dryer in the bathroom, right, to dry them after washing them, moving air carries away moisture. And so when you're tossing food in the wok through the air, you're encouraging evaporation and you're encouraging more rapid cooking. And so that's what the essential part of the stir frying is, or the toss frying. It is something that's going to take a little bit of practice to get there.
Got it. Yeah. All right. What is your favorite stir fry recipe, your go-to?
My go-to stir fry, well, I mean, my go-to recipe in the book would be the Japanese style mapo tofu. It's sort of a hybrid stir fry braised recipe. You start by stir frying ground beef with a bunch of aromatics, and then you add liquid and tofu and let it simmer for a little bit. And that's a dish that, you know, Mapo tofu is traditionally a Sichuan dish from China that has, you know, what's called this mala flavor profile, which is a numbing hot. Comes from Sichuan peppercorns, which numb your tongue, and heat from chilies and this fermented bean paste. That's the traditional dish. There's a recipe for that in the book as well, but that dish made its way over to Japan in the 70s, has sort of been adapted to Japanese tastes over time. And so I grew up eating my mom's version of Japanese mapo tofu, which is flavored with sake and soy sauce and mirin, these sort of, you know, the cornerstones of Japanese flavor. So instead of having this sort of mala, you know, numbing hot flavor profile, it has much more of a sort of sweet and savory flavor profile. That's the dish that I have made, I think, by far the most in my life. And it's one that I grew up eating. It was my favorite dish growing up, and it's one that now I serve to my own kids. Well, my son is 6 months old and he just started on solids, but my daughter has been eating this dish. It's the thing that I make, like, when I feel like, oh, what do I make her today, and I know that I just want to make something that she will eat with no questions asked. I make Japanese mapo tofu.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That's food columnist and cookbook author Kenji Lopez-Alt. His latest cookbook is called The Wok: Recipes and Techniques. And now I am super hungry for anything that I can cook in a wok. So thank you. Thank you very much, Kenji. All right. That's it for us today on Press Play. If you want to contact us and tell us what you want to hear more of, what you like, you can tweet us or you can hit us up on Instagram. We're at KCW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Happy eating. I will see you tomorrow.